Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the show today. Today's show is all about empowerment, about how we empower ourselves. Coming up at 12:30, relationship expert and psychologist Dr. Deborah Mandel joins us to tell us how to go from doormat to diva in only 9 steps. Her new book, Dump That Chump, tells you how to take charge of your life, boost your self-esteem, how to get over Mr. Wrong, and make room for Mr. Right. And that's coming up at 12:30. But first, I'm joined by Jamie Clawson. Jamie's one of the Seattle holistic business owners that we researched and selected to profile on Conversations Live. Now, if your stomach churns at the thought of dealing with attorneys, which I know many people have this issue, then you'll want to listen in, because Jamie is an attorney with a difference. And by that, I mean that she practices holistic law. Let me introduce her and we'll learn more about her and what the term holistic attorney means, and more importantly, what that term means for us. And also in this segment, we'll learn how to prevent one of the most critical common life planning mistakes that women make. It can also be one of the most detrimental mistakes that we make. So we're going to learn more about that from Jamie in just a moment. Well, Jamie Clawson, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm pleased to have you here. So let's talk a little bit about what holistic law means. What does that mean to you as an attorney? What does it mean to me as a potential client?
At its most basic, holistic law is an approach to law that really looks at the client as a whole person, that recognizes that whatever legal issue has brought them to deal with the attorney is just a small part of their life, that it's just a tiny segment of the issues that are important to them. And it makes sure that you get to know the client's family, their values, their priorities, and you come up with a legal solution or a non-legal solution that matches those, and don't just look at the individual legal problem in isolation.
Okay, and why did you choose holistic law?
Well, I actually started off in my estate planning career doing pro bono estate planning for people with AIDS, often people in terminal situations. And I found that for them, you know, issues of who was going to get their money was the last issue on their mind. They were interested in maintaining control over healthcare decisions, patching up relationships with family if possible, maintaining independence and control over their lives. And that introduction really made me realize that those issues are issues that should be important to every person who's doing estate planning and should really be the focus, but that often what is the focus is just taxes or legal documents. And so I wanted to bring that approach to a wider spectrum of clients.
Okay. And we're going to talk about estate planning in a little while, because that's something that, you know, I know as from my former career that many people really get messed up over. It really causes them great hardship and a lot of difficulty and a lot of angst if somebody passes on and hasn't left things in good order. And, you know, we have a tendency to rush through the day and think, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do it next week, or I'm young, or I'll do it when the kids are grown. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves divorced or abandoned, or you know, we don't know where our money is, or you know, we may pass on and whoever's left to deal with our mess doesn't know where all that money is. So I wonder if, I think that you said you were the only estate planning holistic attorney in Seattle. Is that correct?
So far. I'm hoping I'll soon have many colleagues. And, but so far, I'm the only estate planning attorney who takes a really conscious, holistic approach.
Okay. And you started this business for yourself because... why? There's nothing else around, right?
Well, I wanted to try this. And holistic law does require sort of a different practice model than the way a lot of attorneys work. You know, it means spending more time with your clients, and that means less money per hour. So you have to find some unique ways to practice. I practice out of my house. I do a lot of creative things to keep overhead low so that I can provide clients with this sort of unique approach. And that wasn't something I could really find that would work at another law firm. So I had to make my own.
I was telling you before the show that the first time I came across holistic law practices was when I met a holistic divorce attorney. And I thought, you know, that is such a great idea. And she explained that they after all the legal stuff is done, they have a little ceremony at the end. And I thought that is so neat, because You know, most marriages start in a church or a religious ceremony, and they end in a court of law, which has never made any sense to me. But but I always thought that was such a great idea.
And that is an area of law where there are a really growing number of holistic practitioners. The idea of taking what people have learned from that mm-hmm. and moving it into other areas of law is sort of the next step in where practitioners like myself and like others that are trying this in new areas are sort of breaking some ground.
Mm. How do you get to know your clients? You say that holistic law differs because you don't just deal with a legal problem, you get to know your clients and their family. How does that work?
I usually meet with my clients. I do a free half-hour consultation with all my clients to make sure that I'm really the right attorney for them and that they're the right clients for me. Mm-hmm. I like to do that in their homes. It's a great chance for me to kind of see how they live, and people are usually more comfortable, less on their guard in that setting. And I give them questionnaires I ask them to fill out, and I ask questions that a lot of attorneys don't. I ask them about their religious beliefs, about their big picture values for their family, what their hopes and dreams are for their kids if they have children. I kind of make them do that first, before we start talking about just the dollars and cents. And I think the other big difference is I do all of my work on a flat fee. So people pay me one fee for their complete plan. I find that if people are paying by the hour, it's just so tempting to look at their watch and not think that it's worth mentioning that they have a tense relationship with this sister or that they've had issues with their mother in the past about control. And because those feel like they're unimportant issues when you're paying sort of by the minute. But those are often, when it comes to making a good plan that's really going to work for your family, the most important issues.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I'm sure we've all been in situations where we're like, well, I need to get this answered, but do I really want to pay X amount per minute to find the answer out? So I think that's a good point to make. Now, I said at the top of the hour that we one of the most critical life planning decision that I used to see people make was mm-hmm. not making plans for when they pass on. Or the other common thing is, you know, wives who, oh, the husband always manages the money, and vice versa, actually. Mm-hmm. I've seen vice versa when, you know, the woman always manages the money and then the husband passes on, and or divorce is another issue. And suddenly they're left not knowing how much they've got, how much they owe, and it can sometimes be a very unpleasant surprise for people.
I deal with a lot of older women, unfortunately, that are calling me for that very reason, because their husband has passed on and their husband maybe has done a very complete estate plan and has a full notebook of legal documents, but they've never really explained what those meant to their wife. And so the wife has no idea sort of where her money is and what the rules are governing it. And I come out and talk to them about that. So the ideal is that if a couple is going to do a plan, they're going to do it together and really understand what they're doing. And you know, in my mind, a simpler plan that both people really understand is almost always better than a more complicated plan that only one person understands, because that's what's going to make that transition, which is a horrible transition when you lose someone that you've been married to for a long time, the easiest. And that's usually what people, when it comes down to it, what they want. They want to take care of their loved ones, not just financially, but emotionally as well.
Yeah. So in your experience, who should estate plan? And I think, you know, one thing I want to get clear here is when we say estate planning, people often dream up, you know, I've got to have this massive estate to make it worthwhile doing. And that's not true.
No. And in fact, I tell people that if you have a lot of money and you die, you know, to a certain extent, the worst case scenario is that money is wasted in figuring out who should get it, and maybe some money goes to somebody who you wouldn't have wanted to have it. If you don't have a ton of money, if you don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to waste on money going to the wrong place or getting caught up in legal fees, estate planning is really more important, because you know, the saddest thing I see is, for example, older people who are on low income, who haven't taken the time to do a plan to set up powers of attorney. Then their families have to do a guardianship in order to get the kind of control they need to help their mom to pay bills or to make medical decisions. And the result is that the mom's finances are completely wiped out, and she has gone through what can be a pretty traumatic guardianship proceeding that wasn't necessary. So I think that's the biggest misconception people have, is that estate planning is for the rich. Estate planning is often more vitally for the middle class and for low-income people.
Yeah. So tell me what goes into estate planning. What kind of things do you look at?
Well, ideally, any estate plan should include a disability plan. That's something I feel a lot of people overlook. And that's a plan for who would make medical decisions for you if you became disabled, what kind of decisions you would want made, and who would manage your finances if you were in a situation where you couldn't. Only 10% of us die without going through some period of disability. So that's a plan 90% of people are going to use if they make one. And for younger people, they're much more likely to become disabled than they are to die. So in addition to that, particularly people with kids, you need a will. You absolutely need a will. That's how you are going to communicate not just how your money gets passed on, but who takes care of your children, which is a vitally important issue for most people, and something that people think that they have solved by telling their brother that that's who they want. That doesn't work in court. That's not going to save your family the trauma and hassle and expense of getting that figured out. And then in addition, with my clients, I ask them to take the time to do some non-legal documents, legacy letters to their kids that are a chance to pass on some family stories, some family values, what your hopes and dreams are, messages of affection. And also for parents with kids, I encourage them to write a letter to the people they've selected as a guardian that say what their parenting philosophy is and why they've selected that person. And again, communicate kind of what their dreams are for the future for their children so that they can parent in a way collaboratively with that person even after they're gone.
Yeah, that is so important. And I want to talk more about that, but we need to take a break first. So we'll be right back. We're talking with Jamie Clausen, and I should say that the name of her company is FinneyEstateLaw.com. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Almost 6 million people in the U.S. are diagnosed with bipolar disorder. For some, a monthly doctor's visit and a handful of pills offers little comfort. But with breakthrough research and new medical strategies, there's new hope for people with bipolar disorder. Tune in next Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and hear proven methods for managing your life and work with this discussion of new help for people with bipolar disorder.
Hi, everyone. I'm Buzz.
And I'm Robin, reminding you to catch The Living Life Show Thursdays at 2 p.m. right here on KKNW.
The Living Life Show is your weekly guide to living life better both at home and away.
Each week, we bring you interesting guests and industry experts who share their tips for your home and your vacations.
We even have some great recipes for you to try, and you can even see us make them on our website.
You bet. So be sure to listen Thursday at 2 p.m. to The Living Life Show right here on KKNW.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest this first half hour is Jamie Clausen. She's an holistic attorney, and she's based in Seattle. Her company is called Finney Estate Law. And Jamie, I want to ask you, you were talking a little before the break about what you call legacy statements and parenting statements, which I think are really crucial. I know when my brother went back to England, they did a thing with their kids to say who would take care of them if they both died. Mm-hmm. And the only way I could look after my nieces and nephews was if I moved back to England. That was actually written in there, and mm-hmm. I had to agree to it. So tell us a little bit more about the parenting statements, because that's actually something that I think is very crucial, that the kids are raised with parents' wishes, right?
Yeah, when I'm dealing with new parents, I often remind them of how long it takes them to write the first note they leave with the very first babysitter who takes care of their kids. And I describe the parenting statement as sort of the grand poobah of all babysitting letters. So the time parents take to tell the person who's going to watch their kids for 2 hours about what they want, they should take the time to write the letter to the person that they're contemplating raising their kids for the rest of their life. I encourage parents to share their most difficult parenting situation, how they worked through that, to talk about what does and doesn't work with these kids in terms of discipline, and also to share with the person why they selected them. Sometimes that's really helpful for the parent to know that, the prospective parent to know that they were selected because of their warmth or because of their values or because of their judgment. And that can give them a real sense of why they're in that role and give them some inspiration for how to move forward.
Yeah, I think that's so great. I really do think it's great. And the legacy statement, how does that differ?
Well, the legacy statement is actually something I discovered that comes out of the Jewish tradition of ethical wills. Historically, Jewish families would write a statement passing on their values and as well as passing on their material possessions. And I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
So I encourage people, and it looks different for every person. No two are the same. But I encourage them to talk to their kids, maybe share something about their personal history that they would want the child to remember, or their family history, to talk about what their hopes are. And I think this can also be a nice complement to legal documents, because sometimes there's a desire to sort of parent from the grave by putting lots of restrictions in legal documents and trusts, controlling how money can and can't be spent. And in my experience, that often leads to kids who are very clever about how to get around the provisions of their trust funds, and not necessarily kids that are motivated by the values in those trust funds. So, for example, with college, I tell parents, if you want your kid to go to college, take the time in the letter to write down what going to college meant to you or what not going to college meant to you, mm-hmm. what education has meant to you in your life and why you'd want them to go forward. In my experience, that's something that motivates kids to follow that dream much more than finding out how many credits they have to take to keep getting their check every month.
Sure, sure. And as well as spouses and children who've lost parents, the some of the other groups that I know very much suffer at the end of a life are blended families, same-sex couples and families, and planning for unmarried couples. That's a huge one in today's age. So if I, my partner and I wanted to estate plan as an unmarried couple, how do we go about doing that?
Well, really, there is an immense amount of flexibility that a couple like that has to do an estate plan. And they can do planning in a lot of the same ways that a traditional married couple can do. But they really need to do the planning, because Washington's default rules, if you don't write your own estate plan, assumes that you don't want to leave anything to a long-term partner that you Wow. are unmarried to, or to a stepchild or to a step-grandchild. So if you're in a blended family, you need to be really conscious about doing planning. One of the main differences, unfortunately, for couples who aren't married is that there are new tax issues that they have to deal with that married couples do not. And that's because even though in Washington we have registered domestic partnership benefits, for example, for same-sex couples that can provide them some of the benefits that married couples have, the federal government doesn't recognize that. So in figuring out things like federal estate tax, you may have to be a little bit more creative, which is why it's a good idea for those people to definitely talk to an attorney and not sort of try to do something online and do a workaround.
Yeah, I actually was just telling you during the break, I watched a documentary. It was called In-Laws and Outlaws, I think. And there was a homosexual couple on there who'd been together, I think it was about 50 years. It was a long, 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 long time. And when the one partner died, unfortunately, the other one had absolutely zero say in anything. And it was so sad. It was heartbreaking. So what particular things do they need to be, same-sex couples need to be concerned about?
Well, one thing is they need to be sure that they have done that disability planning, those powers of attorney, so that if they're the person they want to be making decisions, that those documents are in place. If they want to leave property to that person, they want to make sure that things are titled the way they should be titled, houses, bank accounts, life insurance policies, and almost so make sure that they have a will that makes it clear who they want items to go to.
Okay. And what about blended families? Do blended families tend to say, you know, oh, my money will go to your kids and his money will go to his kids? How does that normally work?
Well, that's the way the law assumes it works.
Okay.
But I've never found a typical blended family. And I think that more and more I'm seeing that parents and grandparents really have embraced their role as step-parents. And they really don't view it as being simply a biological tie. And so they do want to think creatively about how they can provide for stepchildren or provide for second spouses while still providing money for their children. And, you know, there's really no end to what you can do other than what's limited by human creativity. So if you're willing to take some time and people are willing to be open and honest and think creatively, we can almost always find a solution that works for families. But they can't assume that the law is going to take care of it for them, because unfortunately the law will assume that if someone's not your blood relation, you don't care about them and you don't want them to take a role in decision making for you. And in most cases, that's not the truth.
Yeah, it's I don't know what to say about that. I've seen some very sad cases where people have been stuck that way. I want to talk about something that's always, I think, very delicate when your parents are aging, but it shouldn't just apply to elderly parents. I mean, I think all parents should do this for their kids. But, you know, there are elderly parents out there who've really not given any thought to estate planning. And how do we approach them as kids, as grown-up kids, and say, look, you need to do something, otherwise I'm going to be left with the mess when you're gone?
I think there's a fear for kids talking to their parents that their parents are going to think that they're anxious for them to die or they're just interested in the money. I find that it often works best if people start by talking about the disability planning and really communicate that the benefit of doing an estate plan is it allows the parent to maintain a level of independence and dignity if something does happen that they won't have if they haven't planned. And often that sort of loving statement about why the child wants them to plan, I don't want to be put in a position where I have to do a guardianship. I don't want to be put in a position where I'm making healthcare choices and I don't really know what you want. That often can help get the parent over that and the child over that discomfort level and get that conversation started. Parents are under the illusion that, you know, if they don't have a lot of money, it's not something that's going to worry their kids. And I think explaining to them that you want to make sure that things are as easy for the family when they pass, that people can really be concentrating on mourning and on grief and not running around and dealing with attorneys and courts and bank accounts in ways that they don't need to, can be motivating too.
Yeah, because whether you're talking about $1,000 or $1 million, the steps you have to go through are pretty much the same, aren't they? And it can be a real headache. What about advanced health planning and alternative medicine? That should be written in there too, you say?
Yes, I think every person should do a healthcare directive that states what kind of healthcare choices they want made. People who have to make those decisions for you, and somebody's going to have to if you're disabled, are going to feel so much more at peace if they know that they're doing what you want done. And most people also would like to maintain that level of control by having done what they want done. I really encourage people who are interested in alternative healthcare practices to put that in that directive and to communicate that they do want openness to acupuncture or to massage or to therapeutic music or whatever sort of modalities have been helpful to them in their life that they're open to. That gives the person a sense of freedom to do that, because that's not something the doctor at the hospital is likely to bring up on their own if it's not in the directive.
Right. And let your kid know you've done that, because I received a directive in the mail from my mother. I didn't know it was a legal document. I had no idea. It just said pull the plug, basically.
And I always talk to parents to clients about making sure that anyone they're naming in documents has those, that the parents have shared them with their children, and also that they're in people's medical records.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, let's talk about something else. Once we've got, let's say we're a newly married couple and we do all this estate planning because we have a baby on the way. How often should we be going back and revisiting our estate plan?
I encourage clients to take a look at their plan every 2 years, just kind of make it a habit to take a look at it, just to make sure that everyone's name's the same, everyone's still alive, people haven't gotten divorced or situations haven't changed, and make sure they're still comfortable with their choices. But the big sort of life events that usually prompt a need is if you get married, you get divorced, you have children. Maybe if your children reach 18, it's time to do some new planning because you're no longer thinking about taking care of them as infants. You've got new issues to think about. Any time that you add grandchildren to the mix is a good time to think about things again. And any time that you do have a health crisis, you make a healthcare directive. It's even if it's fairly detailed, it's a little abstract. If you find that you are diagnosed with a disease, that it's more likely it's going to be needed. If you get a cancer diagnosis or something like that, it's a good time to revisit those documents now that you maybe have a better sense of what choices that person might actually face.
Sure. What about single parents? Because obviously we've got more single parents than ever in America these days. How do we make sure that we've covered our kids okay? What particularly applies to single parents?
Well, for single parents, it I guess depends on why they're a single parent. If the other biological parent is still in the picture, they will be the person who will take over guardianship of the child if they die, unless there's a compelling reason not to. And if there is a compelling reason, like domestic violence or another reason why that person is not the appropriate parent, that parent really needs to take the time to document that. But even if that person takes the kids, you may still want to have a member of your family, for example, controlling the money so that, or some of the money, so that there's a motivation to keep, for that other parent, to keep that kid in contact with grandparents and aunts and uncles and keep that larger family connected. And I'd also encourage that if parents have a, a good working relationship, and hopefully if you have kids, you do, whether you're married or not, make sure that you know about each other's plans. Make sure the other one has a plan, and make sure that what you're doing makes sense together, that the puzzle pieces are fitting.
Okay, good advice. And we've seen an increase in Alzheimer and dementia. There was yet another health report came out last week about baby boomers and dementia. What special considerations do we need to put into our estate plan to make sure we're covered and make sure our kids are covered too?
My grandmother actually has Alzheimer's, and we're very close. So I'm well aware that is something that is an important issue for a lot of families. And I think, again, the best thing to think about is that is a form of disability, and you want to go ahead and do the kind of planning where you've been really clear about healthcare choices and clear about healthcare choices in the case of dementia. If there's a point where you no longer want to receive treatment, you just want to receive comfort care, and that point could be whatever it is for you, whether it's you can no longer recognize your family members or you're no longer able to have your own personality, whatever that point is for you, and you don't want to have care, you need to communicate that. You need to do it in advance, because usually by the time someone has an Alzheimer's diagnosis, they're not going to be in a position to do this kind of planning and do these kind of documents because they won't have the capacity anymore.
We're almost at the end of our show, Jamie, this segment, and I want to make sure we get your website in. So let's go ahead and give that out, please.
It is www.finneyestatelaw, and that's P-H-I-N-N-E-Y, estatelaw.com.
And do you have a phone number for people who aren't on the web?
Yes, it's 206-459-1908.
And again?
That's 206-459-1908.
Okay, and if you didn't catch that, you can always get in touch with me, and I can pass that information on to you. I also want to, at the beginning of the show, you've given us some great information, and you know, I certainly know I need to go back and revisit mine. It hit me one day when I was flying, and they'd had two plane crashes the week before, and I thought, gosh, I need to, we need to get this updated. But I want to just let listeners know that at the beginning of the show, you had said you get to know your clients, but they also get to know you, and you have an art blog. You have a blog on your website, which actually contains a lot of your artwork, and you actually have a show coming up, right?
I do. I'm actually at Santoro's Books on Greenwood Avenue right now. And that is an important part of the holistic law process. Is it's hard to be open with somebody who you don't feel like they're open with you. So that's one reason why some attorneys might not be interested in holistic law. But you do kind of have to open yourself up. And that's been great for me. A lot of my clients are now good friends.
Fabulous. Thank you. I really appreciate you joining us. And I want to let our listeners know you have a free class coming up. When and where?
Yes. On Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Green Bean Coffee Shop, and that's in the Greenwood neighborhood. I'm having a class on green burial and other alternative burial arrangements, which may be of interest to anyone who has sustainability as a value they want to incorporate into their estate plan.
Excellent. Jamie Clausen, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
And we're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Deborah Mandel, who's going to tell you how to get your relationship in order or how to dump that chump. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Across Seattle, humans are vanishing, returning as newborn vampires. With the sun as her enemy, the moon her guiding light. Manali must battle the beast who tortured her. But first, she must face her own demons in Otherworld. Romantic Times magazine calls Gallinorin's best-selling Otherworld series vivid, sexy, and mesmerizing. Darkling by Yasmin Gallinorin, available at bookstores now. For more information, see Gallinorin.com.
Join nanny and parenting coach Meryl Woodard for a new parenting show, Another View, Fridays at 2. right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM KKNW. This is your chance to get those parenting questions answered, as well as tell us what's working for you. She'll talk about alternative health products, too. So consider Another View Fridays at 2 on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. This is Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we were looking at holistic lore in the first part of the show. Today, we are the second half of the show. We're talking with Dr. Deborah Mandel. And Dr. Deborah Mandel is a respected psychologist with 20 years of specialty experience in relationships, depression, anxiety, childhood mistreatment, and general life concerns. She's a very familiar face on national TV shows in programs such as CNN Headline News, The O'Reilly Factor, The Today Show, and more. And she's been quoted in many, many magazines. She's also written several books, including the one we're going to focus our topic around today. And that book is Dump That Chump, From Doormat to Diva in Only 9 Steps, A Guide to Getting Over Mr. Wrong. Dr. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm pleased to have you here.
And this is the perfect time of year to be talking about this because it's time for spring cleaning.
We'll see if we can get our estate plan in order from this, the first part of the show, and now we can do some more spring cleaning on our relationship. And you wrote this book primarily for women, I mean, based for women, but I mean, these principles apply to both sexes, as we know. And you said at some point in the book that you think you actually learned more from your own personal experiences than you did from 20 years as a psychologist dealing in relationships.
Well, yeah, because, you know, you have to really, I think, go through those experiences yourself to really understand what they're like for other people. And I was one of those women who, you know, people would say, why do you keep dating these jerks? You know, I would stay in these dead-end relationships because I had low self-esteem. I didn't think that I could have a better relationship. I was too afraid to be alone. And so I would repeatedly find these people who they weren't good guys, you know. And by the way, this book is absolutely not a man-hating book in any way. It's about loving men and caring about men and wanting to, make our hearts open for the good ones who are going to treat us with respect and kindness, where you feel like the relationship enhances your life as opposed to take something away from it.
Yeah, and it's actually quite funny. As well as having some good tools and some strategic strategies in there, it's actually quite funny as well, which if you're in a bad relationship, you need a little laughter in your life.
Well, and that's what I thought. You know, you bring your own person into it when you're writing a book and not just sitting around like, oh, I'm the doctor expert here who's going to tell you what to do. It's like, hello, girl, I know this firsthand, you know, from beginning to end what this is like. And then, of course, in my own trial and error periods and then also helping countless other women get through these negative relationships and helping them get to the other side and find true love, you know, I couldn't think of anything else I should write about more importantly than this and just put it down on paper and get it out there so people would feel like they had it's really a guidebook. It's more like a coach telling you, look, if you try these different things, I'm pretty darn sure that you're going to start feeling better step by step, step by step.
Yeah. And hopefully we get rid of Mr. Wrong and find Mr. Right if we follow these steps. Now, I wanted to start out with some of the common myths held by women. Even today, with highly successful career women and all the opportunities we have, there are still some myths out there that we hold on to. And one of them, you say, is tone yourself down so that you don't outshine the men around you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, women are notorious for doing that. You know, it's like if you're you go bowling with a guy and all of a sudden you find yourself winning and he frowns on you, then all of a sudden you find yourself losing. That would be toning yourself down. But a lot of times we do that because if we date men or we're married to men who have problems with their own self-esteem and they're very defensive about it, then they're going to only be happy when you're not shining. And if you start shining, they will start to put you down or deflate your ego. And that's just not a healthy relationship. You need a relationship where somebody supports your growth and your shining and who loves to take pleasure in your own advancements and empowerment.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think so many women, given all the opportunities we have today, why do you think so many women do settle for relationships that are less than?
Well, now, there's multiple reasons for that. One being, depending in a large part on what kind of childhood you had, you know, and what kind of relationships you had, observing your parents, how they treated you, you know, those kinds of old emotional wounds can definitely get in our way. But there's all other reasons that we do it, too. One is that sometimes, you know, you fall head over heels for a certain kind of chemistry, and we put too much stock in chemistry sometimes. Now, mind you, I absolutely think that we need to have some level of chemistry for a relationship to work out. I've seen too many women go from great chemistry to no chemistry, and they're just as miserable. You know, so you need to have some of that. But sometimes we have these idealized images of what love is supposed to look like, and you know, we don't really have realistic ideas of what it's supposed to look like. So we end up sometimes sabotaging our relationships, even though we may be with a chump. We actually might be with a good guy, but we're spoiling the relationship anyway.
Yeah. Well, we have a copy of this book to give away today. So and we're going to open up the phone lines in just a minute. But before we do that, let's start looking at some of the 9 steps here. And the first one, the first one is... dump that chump, the Dear John letter, bye-bye talk, and Houdini. You tell us how to do it. But the second one is the one that I was really wanting to talk about on the show, and that's once we've been in a toxic relationship, often we're very down on ourselves. Mm-hmm. How do we start, as you call it, transforming our self-downers into self-uppers?
Well, I think the first thing is, and I have a list of 10 of them. You can find those in the book. But there are things like, I'll never find another guy who will love me. I'm an inadequate lover. I'm not good enough, I'll be alone forever. You know, those are the kinds of downers that we tend to get stuck on, and we dwell on those. So you have to actually at first just recognize if you are telling yourself those kinds of messages, because how we speak to ourselves, how we think about our own selves has a big impact on how we feel about ourselves. So you've got to identify what those are. And like I said, I give a list of 10 of them, and you go through one by one, you go, is that possible? Am I holding on to this guy because I'm afraid of that, or did I hold on to him for so long because I'm afraid of these things? Mm-hmm. And then the more you can recognize what those are, then you can do some of the exercises I suggest in the book, which are to, you know, practice living your life with somebody who has actually the positive belief systems about themselves.
Yeah. Do you think sometimes we hold on too much to the idea of what we think we should have been?
Oh, you mean like blaming ourselves for what we did or didn't
well,
do?
Well, you know, sometimes you think, oh, we could be so great if only, and we hold on to this ideal situation, this idea in our head of what things could be.
Yeah, like we're thinking about potential, but when you look at reality, not what reality actually is. Mm. And so we hold out sometimes for things that are really probably not going to change. I mean, I totally believe that people can change, because otherwise I wouldn't do what I do for a living. I wouldn't write books that help people make changes. Mm-hmm. But there are fundamental things about people that they don't change, particularly if they're not aware of it. So if you're with a guy who repeatedly treats you a certain way, and no matter how many times you've told him that it hurts your feelings or it doesn't feel good, and he persists in doing that, recognizing and knowing that it's hurting your feelings, the likelihood of him stopping that is pretty nil to none.
Mm.
So if you keep hanging on to him, you're really just creating a lifetime of misery for yourself.
Yeah, we need to change our story, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
When is the best time to break up? Because you tell us how to do that, and you give us three choices, and you know, ways to do that. What do you mean by Houdini? That's one of your choices.
Okay. Well, now as you read through the book, you'll see that there's a self-assessment in there, or assessment of your relationship of whether you are even with a chump, because you know there are different levels of chumpiness. And the Houdini method is really, it's recommended for a guy who, you know, maybe he's been abusive, maybe he's really treated you with disrespect, you know, maybe he's had several affairs on you before, you know, you've been with him and now like for the fifth time in a row you find him in bed with somebody else. You know, do you really need to give him an explanation for why you're dumping him?
Mm.
So the Houdini is literally disappearing. It's like, okay, I'm done with you. No more. We're done. Now, obviously, that's not a feasible method for somebody who's living with their partner and married or has kids or things like that. So I definitely talk about that. These are just recommended methods, but you've got to determine what's appropriate given your life circumstance with the person that you're with.
Right. And you say you should never break up in the middle of an argument, which I think many people do, don't they?
They do, because we feel fortified in our anger. But unfortunately, once the anger wears off and we're alone, then we often go through that phase very intensely of regretting what it was that we said or doubting what we really felt. And then we feel like we maybe made an impulsive decision, and we're more likely to rekindle the idea of staying with this person if he were to come back and beg for forgiveness or say, you know, let's try again, I don't want to lose you, I'll be different this time, and all those promises.
Mm. Step four in your book is called From Mad and Sad to Glad, and it's about releasing your anger, and I want to talk about that in just a second, but before we do, I want to let's go ahead and open up the phone lines, Eric, and we have a copy of Dr. Deborah Mandel's book to give away today, and so do you want to pick the number?
Sure, let's take caller number three, lucky number three.
Sounds good.
The magic number, as they say.
All right.
So give us a call at 425-373-5527. That's 425-373-5527, or toll free in Western Washington, 888-298-KKNW. And if you're caller number three, you'll win a copy of the book.
There you go. We're opening up the phones right now. So go ahead, give us a call if you'd like a copy of Dr. Deborah Mandel's book. And so I want to talk about anger, this anger situation. Step four is go from mad and sad to glad. And, you know, we often hear you have to get angry. I was actually told when I was going through my divorce, you need to get angry. And I'm like, why? I could not muster anger to save my life, quite honestly, at that point. So mm-hmm. Why is it important? Do we need to address anger?
No. We need to address it if it's there. We don't need to manufacture it if it's not there. Now, there are reasons that some people don't get angry, and that's because they don't feel like they're allowed to be angry. But there are other people who stay angry for far too long. And my idea about anger is really a secondary emotion. It's not one of the primary emotions. It's the emotion that we have available to us when we need to be in service of our survival needs. So when you're in a situation where you're being offended, mistreated, misguided, devalued, all those things that would bother most of us, those are the times when it's likely for our bodies to get defensive and reactive and to have anger as the front and center emotion. But as soon as you are removed from the actual toxic situation, there's absolutely no reason to be angry anymore. Your body, it's just a waste of your body's energy, and it will keep you stuck in not being able to move on to being able to have a better and happier, more successful relationship the next time around.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you're feeling angry, you want to get it out of your system. You want to see what that emotion is covering up, which often it's sadness and fear.
Mm.
And then you want to move on through those emotions as well and realize, I mean, the biggest part about getting over a chump, mind you, this book is about losing a chump. It's not about losing a good guy. I wouldn't recommend 3/4 of the things I have in that book if you were saying goodbye to somebody you really care about, but
yeah,
you just decided you were a misfit and it wasn't going to be a good relationship for you long term, but you really care about this person. You know, somebody you would want to stay friends with afterward.
Right.
But
right.
I'm saying to sit around and pine and romanticize a relationship with a chump is kind of silly when you think about it, because you haven't lost a precious jewel. You've lost a piece of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, I don't encourage people to demonize their relationship entirely. Even with chumps, most people have some positive experiences and positive memories of the relationship. So you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You can hold on to those precious memories, but you don't want to give them so much power that it makes you not see clearly what really was the dominant day-to-day experience with this guy.
Right, and if they truly are a chump, as you call them, then the less we think about them, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Less
mm-hmm.
energy they take, the better.
Right.
One of the crucial steps is always to take care of yourself, and step five in your book is giving yourself some loving. I wonder if you'd share some ways that we can do that.
Yeah, and that was actually my favorite chapter to write, because that's just the fundamental basis for being able to have a good relationship, is to recognize that we are the keeper of our own needs. It's really up to our own selves to be able to soothe and take good care of ourselves and know how to nurture ourselves when we're down and out. And when we rely exclusively on a partner or a relationship or a parent or somebody else to meet those needs for us, we set ourselves up to be very vulnerable, and we are likely to be disappointed a lot. So yes, learning how to do things like just from getting up in the morning, when you take your shower, don't just take your shower like you're going to rush through it like it doesn't matter. Think about that you're actually doing something really nice for your body. You're cleaning your skin and cleaning yourself and then lavishing yourself with lotion and hanging out with good friends and listening to good music and trusting in your body's ability to communicate with you what it's looking for, whether it's looking for soothing or excitement or stimulation, conversation, and to really learn how to pay attention to your inner body's signals by eating right and exercising and getting enough sleep and knowing that you are the keeper of your needs.
Mm. You talk a little in the book about codependency, mm-hmm. and you call yourself a contact junkie. So I'm wondering, how do we determine the difference between, are we being codependent? Are we just somebody who's very affectionate and likes constant contact, as you call it? How do we go about establishing that within our own minds?
It's to know that you don't fall apart without it. I mean, I think that's a big distinguishing feature. You know, yes, I love contact. My intimate relationships, the ones that have been successful, and the one I have now that is really good, is that I'm with somebody who I'm compatible with in terms of connecting with them. So it's like this person has no problem with me wanting to reach out in the middle of the day just to say hi, mm-hmm. which is if you're with somebody who's more of an avoidant person, not necessarily that they're a chump, but they're not going to want to share that kind of connection with you, then that's going to be difficult in a relationship. But the reality is if I reach out and the person isn't there, I don't fall apart anymore.
Okay.
In the past, I would have really needed that in order to feel okay for the rest of the day, or I would have worried that, oh, I'm not lovable.